of metal echo around his cell. I imagine Eddie sitting hairy-chested in the heart of Pentonville on his smuggled-in burner phone.
Good. Now where is he? Them, where are you?
He's going to sort it out, I can feel it. Norfolk, the woods, I manage. Silence. I guess that wasn't what he was expecting.
Right. Fair enough. And it's just you?
Just me and him, and there's another one. It's clear from my tone that I'm now talking about bodies, not people.
Two. Gunshot?
Yes. No, one gunshot, and the other one is, knife. Knife wound. I'm aware that I'm not coming across well in this conversation. I breathe in again. Exhale.
Okay. You're alone?
Yes.
Isolated there?
Very.
Perfect. Now, Erin, here's what you need to do, sweetheart. You need to bury them. Do you understand? Go back and bury them. That's going to take a while. All right?
I can't focus right now. I can't think. I'm just glad of any direction. I'll do whatever I need to do.
Are you near any houses right now, love?
I look around. Opposite the phone box is a church. Further down the lane is one other building, a run-down cottage, shabby and overgrown. One house, yes, I say.
Okay, nip round the back and see if there's a shovel or something. Take it with you. Now, listen to me. Be careful, sweetheart. You're going to have to bury them properly. It won't be easy, but you'll do it. And call me back once you're done. Different phone box, remember? We'll sort this out. Don't you worry.
He sounds confident. It's so unbelievably reassuring, I want to cry. Right now, I'd do anything for Eddie. Okay. Okay, I'll call you after. Bye. I hang up and head for the cottage garden. And you know what happens next. Chapter 38. Saturday, October the 1st. Tidying up. I'm ruddy-cheeked and covered in mud by the time I get back to the hotel, but my wound is safely hidden under my hat, and my appearance is nothing that can't be explained by some pretty hardcore hiking. I've got the sweat to prove it. In my rucksack are bleach and other cleaning products that I bought from a petrol station on the long walk back from the forest. If you ever need to buy anything suspicious, it helps to buy some Super Plus Tampax at the same time. Cashiers seem to get so flustered by them, they rarely pay attention to the rest of your purchases. They'll want to get that box in a bag for you as fast as possible. Try it. Thankfully, my room is as undisturbed as my door sign requested. It's a mess. Blood, glass, signs of a struggle. I find the bathroom key in the bin. Patrick must have dropped it in there on his way out last night. I looked through Patrick's burner phone before I dragged him into the grave with Mark. Patrick wasn't working for the plain people after all. Mark was the one paying him to follow me. Patrick attacked me last night on Mark's orders. Mark wanted me put out of action. Not killed, to be fair, but hurt enough to stay away. Was he planning on killing me himself later? I pushed the question away for another time. The texts between their burner phones stretch back as far as our second day back from honeymoon. But Mark's tone changes after I had the diamonds valued in Hatton Garden, and he found out about DCI Foster and the SO15 investigation into Holly. It gets darker then, angrier, as he tells Patrick what to do, to keep an eye on me, to frighten me. I remember Mark trying to make me believe I was in danger, trying to make me believe that Patrick was part of SO15's investigation into Holly. It was Patrick calling the house, leaving those answer phone messages. Mark was the person Patrick was waiting for in that restaurant in that message. Mark was trying to spook me, really scare me. He's the one who left the back door open, who moved our photo, who tried to convince me I was going crazy. He wanted me to back off the diamonds. He wanted us to dump them, so that he could go back, alone, retrieve them and sell them himself, without raising my suspicions. He must have feared I'd ruin his plans if the investigation into Holly's disappearance got too close to me, and thus to him. He created his own Swiss account. He must have done it while I was out of the hotel, depositing the money and setting up our Swiss account. I'd find that out from Mark's burner phone. He'd planned to put the money from the diamonds in it, and then start siphoning the mutual Swiss account dry over the next few months. And finally, he was planning on trading the USB himself. But, oblivious as I was, I kept finding new ways to keep us both in the game. I sold the diamonds through Eddie, and then I found the USB and planned to sell that too. It must have infuriated him. I interfered with his plans, and he had to act. Before I buried him, I searched his pockets, looking for a clue, I suppose. Something, anything that might prove it was all a huge misunderstanding, that he loved me, really. I hoped I would find something that would, somehow, show that Mark had actually done it all for me, for us. Of course, I didn't find anything like that. But Mark had two phones on him. His iPhone and the new burner phone he'd been using to contact Patrick. The phone he'd checked our Swiss account with during the deal. He was clever. His own phone was on airplane mode. He must have done that after he texted me that night. Turned airplane mode on in London, no doubt, before he came for me, so that no signal towers would ever know where he was. The last text he sent me was cleverly vague as well. All circumstantial in a court of law. I know where you are. I'll be back soon, honey. Kiss, kiss, kiss. If I had happened to go missing for some reason on my trip to Norfolk, Mark could have pleaded ignorance. He'd covered his bases. A brief scan of his emails on the burner revealed he'd been looking into apartments in Manhattan over the past 2 days. New houses, for his new life, without me. I wonder what I did, what exactly it was that drove him away. I wonder how I could have been so wrong about us, about him. I truly believed he loved me. More than that, I saw it. I swear I saw it. I knew he loved me. Didn't I? But now is not the time. I have to sort this out, because things can get much, much worse if I'm not fast and careful now. I have to tidy up. Mistakes come down to three things. One, lack of time. Two, lack of initiative. Three, lack of care. I strip the bed and soak out the bloodstained sheets in the sink. I let them dry on the heated rail and get started on bleaching the basin and tiles. I scrub the lamp base and replace it on the nightstand, its thick marble still intact after connecting with Patrick's skull. I clean everything, put it all in order, remake the bed, and then strip down for the shower. I let the streaming water run over my forehead, the cut throbbing, all my muscles pound and sing under the hot shower, but I can't relax yet. In the mirror, I pick open my scabbed forehead cut until a drop of blood beads out. I make sure there's water on the floor, and then I smash the largest remaining shard of bathroom door. A satisfying crack. I phone down to reception. My voice is shaky. I need help. The receptionist runs up to assist. It's a different girl from yesterday, older, more friendly. I stand, trembling in my towel. I explain how I just got out of the shower and slipped on the wet floor into the glass of the door. My forehead dribbles red onto my cheek and into my hairline. She's appalled on my behalf. Floor tiles shouldn't be that slippery. She can't apologize enough. Refunds are offered. I say it's fine, I'm fine, just shaken up. She calls her manager, who offers me a free stay. I decline. They offer me a free dinner. Shivering in my towel, I accept. My blood sugar is low. I do need to eat. I already ate all the cookies in the minibar about an hour ago. I dress and go down to eat in the pub restaurant below. The problem of the broken door is solved. The problem of food is solved. I am given a dressing for my wound. The receptionist insists on helping me apply it. It's not until I'm safely on the motorway home that I stop at a service station and call Eddie back from a payphone. It's done. Thank you. Thank you for helping me. I really appreciate it. I feel very close to Eddie. We've been through something together.
It's all right, sweetheart. Happy to help. Just, you know, don't make a habit of it.
He snorts lightly into the receiver. I smile silently. I definitely won't be making a habit of it. I won't, I promise gently. There's no way really to tell him how much he's helped me, how much I owe him. Yet he seems to glean it down the line.
Listen, love, I didn't tell you anything you wouldn't have worked out for yourself. It's just shock. I remember the first time for me, that feeling. Shock does some, does some funny stuff to the brain. But you're all right now.
He's gruff again. Back to reality. Enough of the mushy stuff. Yes, I'm better. I just need to ask you one last thing, Eddie. How long do you wait to report someone missing? Silence from the other end. I can almost hear him blink.
You don't,
he says simply. But what if you have to? I insist. There's a moment's silence on the line, and then I hear him put two and two together. The penny drops. Someone I know isn't coming back.
Right, I see. Right,
he says, and starts to talk me through it. As soon as I get back home, I call Mark's iPhone. It goes straight to voicemail, of course, buried 3 feet deep in the Norfolk woods. I clear my throat. Hi, honey. I just got home. Just wondering where you are. Hope New York was great. I just got back from Norfolk. Wondering where you are. Let me know if you want some dinner left out. I'll see you soon. Love you. I make a kissing sound and hang up. Phase one. Done. Phase two. Get my house in order. I burn the note I left on the stairs in our fireplace. I was never at Caro's. I'll tell the police I was in Norfolk. A mini break while Mark was traveling for work. I tidy our home. I undo all the mess I created searching for the USB before I left. Finally, when it's all done, I slump down exhausted on the sofa in my empty house and stare at the walls, painted York stone white, the color we chose together. Chapter 39, Sunday, October the 2nd. Missing Person. The next morning I wake early. I slept deeply and now every muscle in my body aches, torn and battered from hours of stress and exertion. I rise and make myself a hot chocolate. I need the sugar. I need the warmth. At 7:05, I call Mark's mobile again.
Mark, it's Erin. I'm not sure what's up. I'm getting a bit worried now, so can you call me, please?
I hang up. I go into the living room and light the fire. I'm staying in today. All day. I check the Swiss account. €2 million went in yesterday morning. He must have planned to transfer it over to his new account after the handover. But I do notice around £800,000 is missing from the account. I do not find it in Mark's savings account. I do not find it in his current account. It must already be nestling in his Swiss account, somewhere out there, God knows where. There's no way to find out now. But so much the better for my current purposes. Now that I think about it, it all fits perfectly. The story of Mark will hang together nicely. Mark has been asking around about a client wanting to shift diamonds, a client needing help with certain assets. It will look suspicious. It will. Which is ideal. My husband has stumbled into something he shouldn't have and run away. Or something worse has happened. Perhaps he got involved with the wrong people. We'll never know. They will look, the police, but they will never find anything. There are three stages in documentary filmmaking, and they are research and preparation, patience while the narrative unfolds, And finally, and arguably most important, editing your footage to create a lucid and compelling narrative. I know life isn't a documentary, but if the process works, then why not use it? And believe me, this story is not a story I ever wanted to tell. But here I am. This is what I have to work with. And this is the narrative I have chosen. And it's a narrative I'm sure the police will buy into. In his online bank account, I see he took out £300 from a cash point near our house after he got back from New York. It's the largest cash withdrawal you can make. My guess is he hailed a cab to take him all the way to Norfolk. He knew where I was because of my phone, or because of Patrick. Patrick was following me. He followed me up to Norfolk. He texted Mark to let him know, but he must have been in the air by then. Mark would have known I was there even without turning on the Find My Phone app. Patrick is the bit I can't understand. I'm not sure who killed Patrick and left him crumpled in the woods. Mark or the tall man? Perhaps Mark met up with Patrick after Patrick had attacked me at the hotel. Maybe that's when Mark collected my rucksack, phone and gun. Maybe that's when Mark slit his throat. I found the knife in some leaves near the body and buried it with them both. Perhaps Mark didn't want to risk having to share his earnings. Or perhaps the tall man killed Patrick. Maybe Patrick heard the gunshots, came to investigate, but ran into the man as he left. Too close to the road to fire his gun, perhaps the tall man cut Patrick's throat and let him bleed out onto the leaves. Either way, Patrick is hard evidence of what kind of man I married. I can't quite believe Mark did what he did, having me followed, terrifying me, making me doubt myself, hiring Patrick to attack and rob me. And now they're both dead. I've been trying to pin down the exact moment it all changed between Mark and me. But maybe Mark never trusted me. It's funny. The more I question his reasons for betraying me, the clearer his story becomes, to the extent that it shocks me I didn't see this entire thing coming. How could I not have noticed? But I was so happy. I loved him so much. As I tidied the house, I kept replaying an argument we had 2 months ago, after our wedding menu tasting. The worst argument we ever had. I've tried to forget that argument. What he said that day, I nearly had. I chalked it up at the time to stress, to fear after he lost his job. But now I wonder if that's when all this really started. I remember I didn't know what to do to absorb his fury at me. Everything was going wrong that day, and there was nothing I could do to fix it. I remember him shouting at me, my heart skipping a beat in my chest. I remember thinking, Mark has gone. Just like that, and someone else is standing in my living room. My breathing was shallow, and I remember such a strong feeling of being alone. Completely alone. I told myself not to cry, to be strong, that it wasn't his fault, that it was probably mine. But I remember feeling the sharp prickle of tears behind my eyes. He looked at me then, like a stranger, and turned away. I can't believe you just said that, Mark, I had said. But now, of course, it makes perfect sense. Nothing links Mark to Norfolk. Good luck to the police trying to track the cabbie down who drove Mark all the way to Norfolk, especially when they don't even know he took a cab anywhere. As far as they can ever find out, Mark got off his flight at Heathrow, cabbed home, and then took money from the cash machine and vanished. He never called me. He never saw me. His last text simply said he knew where I was and that he'd see me later. And then he disappeared. And while all this was happening, I was in Norfolk. I have credit card receipts, witnesses. The hotel receptionist can vouch for my head wound. I slipped in the bathroom. I am safe. I back up all the files I want to keep on my laptop onto a hard drive. Eddie's sending someone to wipe my computers and reinstall after lunch. I cancel the impending payment from the Swiss account into my account. I'll stay away from it until everything is done. An hour and a half after the first call of the day, I call Mark again. Mark, where are you? Call me, please. I've checked your flights, and there weren't any delays. Did you miss your flight, honey? I'm getting really worried. Can you call me? I'm gonna call the airline and check now. I hang up. I call BA. They, of course, confirm he made the flight. So where is Mark? I call Mark's parents. I have to hang up the first time around when his mum answers and run to the toilet to vomit bile into the bowl. The second time around, I manage to hold it together. Hi, Susan. Yes, yes, it is. Hi, hi. Strange question, Susan, but have you heard from Mark? I explain the New York business trip and how he was definitely on the flight home, but that he hasn't turned up today. She sounds slightly concerned, but assures me he'll turn up. He's probably lost his phone, or he's got a work thing on. That gives me an idea. I call Hector. He's been spending so much time with Mark that it seems appropriate to check in with him next. Hector hasn't heard from him either. So the last time you saw him was the weekend? I ask. Silence from the other end. And then Hector says something I wasn't expecting at all.
Erin, I haven't seen Mark since your wedding.
He sounds bewildered, and for the first time since what happened in Norfolk, I feel genuinely surprised. Where the fuck was Mark going all those days he said he was meeting Hector? Checking in with Patrick? Setting up his new life in New York? He hasn't called you about work? I ask.
No. Has he found something new?
He asks, cheered by the apparent change of subject. Perhaps he suspects Mark has been cheating on me and using him as an excuse. Who knows? But it's clear Mark wasn't setting up a business with him. Good. I can use that. I move on. One last call. Mark, I don't know if you're listening to these, but no one knows where you are. I just spoke to Hector and he says he hasn't seen you since the wedding. He doesn't know anything about a new business. What the fuck is going on? I need you to call me, please. I'm freaking out here. Call me. I hang up. The trail has been laid. My husband has run off. Tomorrow morning, I will call the police. Chapter 40. Monday, October the 3rd. Empty. After the call, I sit in silence. The empty house, a shell around me. The police will be here in about an hour, they said. There is nothing for me to do but wait. I miss him. It's funny how the brain works, isn't it? I miss him so much I ache. It hurts, and I don't really understand it. I don't understand what happened. I suppose you can never really know a person, can you? When did it change? Did it change the day he lost his job? Or was it always like this? It's impossible to know if we were a good thing that we broke somehow, or a bad thing that eventually became exposed. But either way, if I could just go back now to the way we were, I would. I would, without a moment's hesitation. If I could just lie in his arms one last time, I could live with an illusion the rest of my life. If I could, I would. I don't know why I reach for the phone. It's not part of the plan. I just want to speak to him one last time, and it can't possibly hurt. I dial Mark's mobile number, and for an instant, when it connects, my breath catches in my throat and I think he's answered, that he's alive after all, and everything that happened before was just some kind of trick. He'll explain everything and he'll be on his way home to me, and I'll get to hold him in my arms again. But of course it's not him. He's not alive. It wasn't a trick. And he's not coming home to me. It's just his voicemail message. His deep, assured voice, my favorite sound in all the world. And when the tone sounds at the end of it, I can hardly speak. Mark, my voice comes out cracked and thick. I miss you so much. I wish you would just come home. Please come home, Mark. Please, please, please. I don't know why this happened, why you went away from me, but I'm sorry. I'm sorry if I wasn't good to you, if I didn't do the right things, say the right things. I'm sorry. But I love you more than you will ever, ever know. And I always will. I put down the phone and cry in my empty house. I made a lot of bargains with a god I don't believe in last night in bed. I would give back all the money for how it was before. Everything back the way it was. Before the police arrive, I pore through our photo albums. We put them together last Christmas after the engagement for our future kids, Mum and Dad when they were young. So many memories. His face in the firelight, blurred Christmas lights behind him, the smell of smoke, mulled wine, pine, my fingers running across his thick sweater, his hair on my cheek, the scent of him, close, his weight, his kisses, his love. Was it real, any of it? It felt real. It felt so real. They were the best days of my life, each day with him. In my heart, I believe it was real. He was scared of failing. He was flawed. I know. I'm flawed too. I wish I could have saved him. I wish I could have saved us. He lost his job. That's all that happened, really. But I know what that means to some men. People died after the financial crash. Some jumped, and some took pills or alcohol. Mark survived. He survived 8 years longer than some of his friends. He knew he couldn't go back to what he did before, and he didn't want to start over. He didn't want to be less than he had been. He was terrified, I see that now, of going backwards. Going back home to East Riding, back to the bottom, back to where he started. And fear is corrosive. I wish I'd seen it. I wish I could have fixed it. But it's done. He's gone, and I am alone. I don't think I'll try again. I don't think I could. I'll love Mark until my dying day. Whether we were real or not, I loved him. Fuck, I miss him. When the police arrive, I'm a mess. Chapter 41. Saturday, December the 24th. What happened next? I made that missing person call over 2 months ago now. The missing persons team wanted everything. His friends' phone numbers, addresses, family, work contacts. I gave them his computer, his bank information, told them all the places he frequented. I told them about the bank letting him go, the arguments we'd had about it, and how I believed we'd come through it. I told them about his new business plans. I told them about Hector, what Hector said to me on the phone that day. I told them everything they wanted to know. They even took his old toothbrush for DNA. 3 days after that, DCI Foster turned up on my doorstep too. My connection with another investigation had been flagged by his office. Mark's disappearance wasn't being investigated by SO15, of course, but it had piqued their interest. Andy wasn't there on official business, he told me, but he did have a few questions for me. I answered them, remembering the calls from him I hadn't returned, guilt flushing my cheeks. I suppose it's hard to believe that one person can be connected to two missing persons and not be involved in both disappearances. But then, if I've learned anything recently, it's that life sometimes is weirdly random. Convincing Andy that there was nothing to see was difficult, but In the end, I'm a lot of things, but I'm not part of a terrorist organization. I never had anything to do with Holly and her flight to Syria. And Mark was a lot of things too, but he certainly didn't flee to Syria like Holly. It took me a while to convince Andy of that fact, though. And if the police weren't bugging me before that day, they definitely started bugging me after. I keep my eyes peeled in the news for anything about a missing plane, but nothing has surfaced in the past 2 months. The plane people seem to have vanished without a trace. I often think about those people deep underwater. I wonder if they're still down there in the darkness, still safely strapped in their seats. I try not to, but I do. I can't help but wonder what was on that USB, why it meant so much to the man in the woods, and I assume to whoever he worked for. I've thought about it a lot. Those endless files full of encrypted text. Were they accounts, details of companies, individuals' names, addresses? I remember those emails I found in the Russian account back in Bora Bora. Shell companies, arms, hacked data. I don't know. Maybe. But I'm glad I didn't get a chance to decrypt it. I'm thankful for Eddie's advice. I'm pretty sure they would have come looking for me if we'd actually read or copied whatever was on that USB. And what would I have done with that information anyway? I steered clear of calling Eddie after the police came. Luckily, my follow-up interview with him was booked for the beginning of this month. Phil and I went to his house. Eddie Bishop's actual house. Simon was there too. Lottie was there. I guess Eddie and his daughter made up. God knows how. Simon had been right. Lottie's crying must have been a good start. I suppose Eddie is a pretty persuasive guy, and Lottie seemed happy enough. After filming, Phil left us alone for a couple of minutes while he nipped to the loo. Lottie was with her kids watching cartoons in the TV room. Eddie thanked me again for the favor, for talking to his daughter. He pulled me into a hug, and as he pulled me close, he whispered in my ear, "All sorted now, sweetheart." "All sorted, Eddie. All sorted," I whispered back. "Glad to hear it. Listen, I'm going to need you to do me another favor, sweetheart, at some point. Nothing too big. Nothing you can't handle," he said, and released me from the hug with a sly smile. Simon grinned at us. "You better watch yourself, Erin. He's a wrong'un, you know." "So am I," I thought. It was nice there. I felt welcome. I felt accepted. I suppose I'm part of the group now. Another favor. I should have seen that one coming. He's got my back, though. I know that. And I owe him, don't I? I'm staying at Alexa's house at the moment. For this week, anyway. A fugitive from my own life, I suppose. I just don't want to be alone in our house on Christmas morning. Not for all the money in the world. Alexa and her father invited me. I can hear them pottering around in the kitchen downstairs. We're having ham tonight. Apparently it's a Christmas Eve tradition. New traditions, new beginnings. They've both been really supportive since it all happened. Since Mark disappeared. I know what you're thinking. I'm starting to believe my own lies, and yeah, you're right. But I'd rather believe my lies than the truth in Mark's eyes in that clearing. Sometimes I think I can hear him, at night, rustling around in the darkness of our bedroom. I sleep with the hall light on now. I keep something heavy by the bed. I'm having Mark's child. Our child. I'm 21 weeks pregnant. Second trimester. I have a bump. According to my app, the baby is the size of a grapefruit now. Her little heart is fully formed and it's beating at 3 times the speed of mine. She's more alive right now than I'll ever be again. I don't know how, but I know she's a girl. I just know. Alexa's IUI worked. 2 weeks after the police came to my house, Phil, Duncan and I crowded back into Dr. Prahani's consultancy room to film Alexa receiving the news. It was a good day.
Her pregnancy is not too far behind mine. It's funny how things work out. It's going to be nice to have someone to go through it all with, and I haven't heard from Caro once since everything happened. Well, a few phone calls, a coffee, but nothing really. Not that I mind. Caro reminds me of who I used to be, and I'm not sure I understand that person anymore. I don't think I'll ever tell Alexa everything about what happened, even though she's become a good friend now. She told me not to let it all get to me. Of course, she thinks Mark has run off, my missing husband, but her advice still worked for me. She told me not to let it make me angry, not to let it break my heart, but to remember that we all lose the things we love the most, and how we have to remember that we were lucky to have them at all in the first place. Sometimes you're the lamppost, sometimes you're the dog. I could definitely take a leaf out of Alexa's book. She makes me laugh, which is something I realize I haven't done for quite a while. Sometimes the right people come into your life at just the right time. But then I think of Mark, and of course, the wrong people do too, don't they? Sometimes it's hard to tell them apart. Maybe I will share all of what happened with Alexa one day, we'll see. After all, she did tell me her story. I'm going to leave the money alone until after the baby's born. I can handle the mortgage until then. I'll be able to sell the house as soon as I'm granted guardianship over Mark's financial affairs in a couple of months. Although it will be a full 7 years until they can officially declare him dead. But I can wait that long. I'm patient. I'll keep working, keep filming. I'll do one more favor for Eddie. I'll use the Swiss money to help once she's born, and when my daughter is 7, and I'm legally free, maybe we'll leave this country. Maybe we'll take the money and disappear. I don't know yet. We'll see. But I'm excited for the future. Our future. It's 7:39 that evening when Alexa calls out my name from the kitchen. I'm upstairs napping in the guest room, my room. She calls my name, just once, clearly, loudly. And I get a feeling in my chest I haven't had for 2 months. Fear, tight and sharp and sudden. I know from her tone, something is happening. The sounds of Christmas Eve cooking have ceased now. The house is eerily still. I follow the sound of the television downstairs and into their cozy kitchen. The scent of our Christmas maple roasted ham wafts from the closed arga. Alexa and her father stand, frozen, their backs to me, staring wordlessly at the wall-mounted television. They do not turn when I enter. I slow to a halt as I join them, and the sense of what I'm seeing hits me. On the screen, BBC News 24, a live feed to a shop-lined street, a deserted London street, maybe Oxford Street, but it's abandoned. So it can't be Oxford Street, can it? Oxford Street wouldn't be abandoned on Christmas Eve. Then I see the police cordon, police tape across the entire road, an ongoing event, a breaking news event. We watch in horror as a crouching figure makes a sudden break from the safety of a shop front, bright with Christmas lights, stumbling blindly out from cover and into the wide, empty expanse of the road. The shadow sprints low and fast, terrified towards the cordon, away from something we can't see, away from something terrible. The crawl scrolls across the bottom of the screen. Ongoing incident. Fatalities. 2 attackers. Armed police presence. If there's a reporter speaking, I don't hear them. Everything around me muffles to silence as 2 photos flash up in the corner of the TV screen. The identities of the attackers. I recognize one of the faces instantly. Alexa turns her head now to look back at me, to make sure I see what she sees. The photo is of Holly. My Holly. I look back at the screen, at Holly's pale young face. It's not a mugshot they've used for her picture. That's the first thing that occurs to me.
I don't know why that's the first thing that occurs to me, but it is. The photo they've used is a holiday snap. From before prison. Before the burning bus, before any of this. And then it hits me so hard my breath catches in my throat. Something awful has happened. She's done something terrible this time. Something truly, truly terrible. Her words come back to me. That day in prison when I asked her what she planned to do next. You'll have to wait and see, won't you? But expect great things, Erin. Great things. She told me. She told me she would do this, didn't she? I knew. In a way, I always knew. Not something like this, obviously, but I knew. But what could I have done? What can you do? You can't save everyone. Sometimes you just have to save yourself.
This is Catherine Stedman. We hope you've enjoyed this unabridged production of Something in the Water. This program was directed by David Roper. Text copyright 2018 by Catherine Stedman. Production copyright 2018, Heavy Entertainment. All rights reserved.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.